Hey, this is Olivia.
And I'm Tashana.
We're the hosts of Something's Not Right. We do a bunch of research and then we tell each other crazy stories. They're usually about true crime, but we're down to talk about anything strange or disturbing.
So if that sounds like your kind of thing, and you don't mind a little salty language, check us out. For more info on Something's Not Right, visit notrightpodcast.net.
The podcast world gets bigger every day. It's the Wild West, and Himalaya wants to be your guide. Himalaya is a brand new podcast app that has all of your current faves and will help you find new ones. Whether you're a podcaster or a fan, Himalaya has got your back. It's free, super easy to use, and you can show your favorite podcasters some love with Himalaya's tip jar. You can find and download Himalaya on the App Store or Google Play Store today. And don't forget to follow Southern Fried True Crime while you're there. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. In the year 2000, Tracy Fortson was 36, a single mother, and the first female sheriff's deputy in Oglethorpe County, Georgia. That's no small feat in a largely rural county serving tiny towns, but Tracy was a classic tomboy. She rode horses, liked to hunt and fish, drove big trucks, and lifted weights. She was tough and didn't suffer fools. And today, she's sitting in prison for shooting, stabbing, and then burying her 250-pound bodybuilder boyfriend in a watering trough filled with concrete weighing nearly a ton. Despite her athleticism, some people have trouble believing she could commit the crime. But for most people in her small community, she was the first and only suspect. To this day, she denies it. She insists she was framed. The evidence against her is circumstantial, but there is so much of it. As a sheriff's deputy, she left a trail so obvious it almost looks too obvious. And the people she insists framed her were her brothers in blue. The tiny sheriff's department where she worked and had just filed a sexual harassment claim against. Welcome to Episode 42, The Deputy and the Bodybuilder. Oglethorpe County, Georgia lies 5 counties and about 80 miles east of Atlanta. Athens is the nearest big city, just a county over or a 15-minute car ride. The county seat of Oglethorpe is in the tiny town of Lexington, which has just a little over 200 residents and only one traffic light. In part of the Treaty of 1773, the Creek and Cherokee ceded a large tract of land to General James Oglethorpe, the English philanthropist who founded the Georgia colony 60 years before. The county of Oglethorpe was formed in 1793, coinciding with the invention of the cotton gin. Cotton quickly surpassed tobacco as the area's main cash crop. After the Civil War, the plantation system was replaced by tenant farming, but both white farmers and former slaves who stayed to become sharecroppers were caught in the inevitable poverty cycle caused by tenant farming rampant in that time period. There was a brief time of prosperity when gold was discovered in the Flatwoods section of the county, but the mines didn't produce as expected and many residents moved west. Then the farming community was hit hard by the Great Depression. The area never really returned to prosperity, and today, small farms operate next to commercial farms there, with granite quarries and lumber production contributing to the local economy. There are under 15,000 residents there today, with about 12,000 being served by the Oglethorpe County Sheriff's Office when Tracy was a deputy. Tracy Lee Fortson was born in 1965 and grew up an only child in Winterville, Georgia, located in Clark County, about 10 miles from where she would work for the Oglethorpe Sheriff's Office. Her family wasn't dirt poor, but they weren't exactly middle class either. Her father was an alcoholic who beat her mother regularly. Tracy witnessed much of the abuse, including times when her father pointed a gun at her mother. By the time she was a teenager, she was intervening. She claimed to have many physical fights with her father, and that once, after she ran him out of the house, he tried to run her over with his truck, but was stopped by old railroad ties in their yard. When Tracy's mother got the courage to file for divorce right after Tracy graduated from high school, her father fought her tooth and nail over everything. Tracy's mother just wanted to sell their house and split the proceeds. She wasn't asking for alimony or other stipulations. But in the end, she settled for $10,000 and bought some land only a couple of miles down the road from her ex-husband, where she put a mobile home for her and Tracy to live. But his drunken antics didn't stop after the divorce. He would push his way into the trailer and beat her mother when Tracy wasn't there. He ran off any other men her mother tried to date. After high school, Tracy meandered a bit. She had considered joining the Marines, but when she was 15, she had begun a relationship with a 19-year-old that dominated the end of her high school years. According to Tracy, it was a toxic relationship. She said the boyfriend was jealous and possessive. When she turned 18, she started working at Georgia Square Mall at the information desk and became enamored with an older security guard. He was around 30 years old. Though a small relationship formed, he broke her heart when he married another woman. Soon Tracy set her cap for another man in uniform she spotted at the mall. He was an older, local policeman, and he asked Tracy out right away. He really courted Tracy, taking her out in his patrol car after shifts, taking her to nightclubs even though she was underage. She was already infatuated with him when she found out he was married. But she kept seeing him, even after his wife had a baby, even after his wife found out. But when the wife left him, he grew chilly to Tracy quickly. The hot affair didn't feel so hot once he had lost everything. Not long after this, Tracy tried to kill herself by overdosing on Valium. She did get better and put the pieces of her life back together, but her taste in men didn't really improve. Still just 18 years old, she fell in love and married and had her daughter Elise not long before her first divorce when she was 20 years old. She married and divorced again in the subsequent years. She said neither marriage lasted 18 months, and after that and the earlier toxic relationships, Tracy sort of took herself off the market. She spent years working odd jobs before applying to be a deputy at the Oglethorpe County Sheriff's Department in 1997. She worked hard, and that applied to her personal life, too. She owned her own home with a lot of property, where she kept a horse and several dogs, and she was constantly working on her home and land. She liked the physical labor and was capable. As a cop, she liked to work out. Being strong and in shape was essential to her job, especially as a woman. Tracy stood 5'6" tall and weighed about 140 pounds with shoulder-length mullet-styled hair. It was the business-like haircut for police women at the time. She was and still is a very attractive woman, and at the time, she loved to tan. In 1997, before she became a deputy, Tracy actually worked at a tanning salon when Doug Benton walked in. He also sported a mullet, tight spandex shorts, and an earring. He had come from the Gold's Gym next door. He was puffed out with muscles, but also strangely had a beer gut. He immediately hit on Tracy, who wasn't really interested, but gave him her pager number anyway. She agreed to a date, but then called and canceled. When she had talked on the phone with him the first time, she heard a small child in the background. When she asked, he admitted it was his son and said that he was in the middle of his second divorce. He wasn't surprised or mad when Tracy called back to cancel. Having survived two divorces herself, she wasn't interested in a relationship with a man in the throes of his second divorce with a small child to boot. 2 years later, Tracy was having lunch with her father on a Friday in September in Athens, Georgia. The two had evidently repaired their relationship and had a standing lunch date every Friday. When Doug Benton walked into the restaurant, Tracy was immediately attracted to him. She thought he looked familiar but couldn't place him. That's because in the 2 years since they first met, he had lost the mullet, the earring, and the beer gut, and now he looked like a real bodybuilder. This time, she kept their first date. Douglas Benton had been born in Michigan in 1962. He was self-employed as a welder and was intensely involved in bodybuilding. He had won several bench press competitions and could bench 500 pounds. Photographs of Doug show your typical swollen, tan gym rat. And though he was now supposedly clean and sober, he had quite a past with drug and alcohol abuse. I say supposedly because he was on steroids, and it wasn't any secret he had roid rage. Tracy said he had anger issues. His best friend, Jeffrey Bennett, said it was depression issues. Either way, both types of issues would be magnified by steroids. Doug also used to supposedly work as an enforcer for a local drug dealer. But he explained to Tracy that he had turned on the dealer and helped to put him away. Tracy said that he worked as a criminal informant and bragged to her about cleaning up the nearby Madison County Sheriff's Department. Whatever that meant, Tracy wasn't sure. Doug lived in the tiny town of Colbert with less than 500 residents located in Madison County. He said his trailer and property had been used for surveillance for the sheriff's department to watch a nearby meth house. He told her he had put all of that drug business behind him, and now, along with his welding business, Doug raised and sold exotic birds and also worked as a bouncer at local strip bars, a job Tracy said he enjoyed because he liked to inflict pain. He was still evening the score from a childhood of bullying. Doug stood 5'9" tall, and while that isn't very short, he had been much smaller growing up. It's why he worked out so intently. And obviously, 5'9" can still be made fun of by the sort of cretins that will find anything to tease about. Doug was the type to cryptically refer to his past, either in boasting or in shame and secrecy. And Tracy just learned to let it be a part of his mystique. She was falling hard for him. The pair were spending all of their free time together. Tracy loved to ride motorcycles, and she found out that Doug owned a chopper he had lent to a friend. He got the bike back and gifted it to her and then bought a new Harley so they could ride together. They loved being outdoors for walks in the park, going for rides, and Doug even promised to learn to ride a horse for her. They ate out all the time, and Tracy worked crazy hours as a new deputy, often 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., so Doug would go pick up Elise and then Tracy from work and take them out to dinner. And they started working out together. Tracy belonged to a gym, but at this point, Doug had built his own home workout studio in his garage and had a daily time he worked out with his neighbor and best friend, Jeff Bennett. The two met at 4 p.m. every day to pump iron. When Doug started dating Tracy, naturally their mutual interest in working out was another thing they started doing together. Tracy would later claim that Jeff Bennett was bitterly jealous about this. He liked his solitary workouts with his best friend. Tracy was intruding. Tracy didn't really like Jeff from the beginning. She found him sarcastic towards her, and he was pissy about missing his workout with his friend. Tracy told Doug she belonged to a gym and didn't mind working out there, but Doug insisted they could all work out together. It wasn't a great situation, with Jeff jealous and Tracy feeling like a third wheel. Jeff Bennett would later be a witness in Tracy's trial, and he characterized Tracy and Doug's relationship as very volatile. He said the negativity was on Tracy's side. He said she was manipulative and controlling. Tracy essentially claims the opposite of this, that Jeff was jealous and domineering, not her. But regardless, Tracy claims that in the spring of 2000, she and Doug were madly in love and building a life together. She had recently found out that he had a second son, something she was angry that he hid from her. But neither child lived full-time with Doug, and Tracy was ready to be serious with a man again. She later said that she hadn't loved anyone like this since Elise's father. By now, Tracy had shed most of her rookie status as a deputy. But as the only woman there, she still put up with a lot. The culture of the Oglethorpe Sheriff's Office was one of good old boy attitudes and teasing. Tracy got her fair share of sexist jokes, which she initially blew off. But when Doug stopped by to see her one day, a fellow deputy laughed and said he was so short she'd lose him in high grass. Tracy told Doug about this. I'm not sure why she chose to tell him, except that she said she told him everything, and I also think there was a side of Tracy that liked to see Doug pop off. Once Doug was pissed about being made fun of, Tracy started confiding all of her problems with the department to him. Every sexist joke that she had once blown off and even laughed at just to get along was now a personal barb designed to throw Tracy off of her game and hopefully convince her to quit the department. This is Tracy's side of the story. She tells her side of things to author Michael Phelps in his book on the case called Targeted. It's an interesting format in the true crime book genre. Phelps worked with Tracy, emailing with her from prison. And like with all men in her life, she had a prickly relationship with the author, and he pulls no punches in exposing this side of Tracy. But back to the timeline, Tracy now told Doug that one of the running jokes at the sheriff's office is that she used to be a stripper. It wasn't true, but according to her, her male co-workers would not drop the joke. Later, Sheriff Ray Sanders would say that Tracy was initially a good deputy. He said her problem started when her personal life changed, meaning she became combative at work once she started dating Doug. Tracy said she began complaining about her salary and the working conditions. Those are her words. She had yet to charge sexual harassment. But in February of 2000, Tracy up and walked out of her job without notice. She said that she did this with Doug's encouragement, who told her she should file a sexual harassment claim because, quote, she was sitting on a gold mine. In April, she filed for unemployment, and now she did report sexual harassment. Sheriff Sanders, who claims he had not planned to fight Tracy's claim, now felt he had to because of the harassment accusation. So he fought her claim, and as Tracy had no proof and had walked out herself, she lost. Also important to note, since she said her salary was an issue, she had received a raise just a month before she walked out. But getting nowhere with the unemployment office, she filed a sexual harassment case against the sheriff and the whole department at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Atlanta. She got a local attorney there and claimed she had audio tapes of the sheriff that would prove her case. Doug contacted a local newspaper, and now the entire community of Oglethorpe knew what had already been whispered about. Tracy Fortson was coming for the department. She had the support of her boyfriend, and she supposedly had tape recordings of the sheriff himself harassing her. Now I'm going to pause for a word from our sponsors. I don't know about you, but meal planning is my least favorite thing to do. I don't have the time or patience to search online or flip through recipe books. But Every Plate has taken the irritation and guesswork out of cooking by planning, shopping, and delivering fresh ingredients right to my door. Every Plate is a meal kit delivery service like none other. At $4.99 a plate, it's cheaper than fast food, but so much more delicious and nutritious. I pay more than that when I treat myself to a latte. I've got a picky eater at home who won't touch a vegetable, but he gobbled up Every Plate's chicken sausage linguine like it was his last meal, even though it had zucchini and onion in it. Now my kids love opening the new box each week to see what we're going to try next. Every Plate's recipes are simple yet savory, satisfying my whole family while saving me time and money. Southern Fried listeners can enjoy 6 free meals across your first 3 weeks, as well as free shipping on your first delivery. Just go to everyplate.com and enter promo code SOUTHERNFRIED6. That's everyplate.com, promo code SOUTHERNFRIED6. Zola is the wedding company that will do anything for love, and it's reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even more happy. Join the 500,000 couples who decided to take the stress out of wedding planning by creating a free wedding website with their dream registry, invitations, and planning tools all online and in one place. The free Zola website takes just minutes to set up and has over 100 beautiful website designs to choose from. Personalize your Zola site with your favorite photos and stories of how you two met. You can post travel accommodations and even recommend fun activities for your guests to enjoy while in town for your wedding. There is a section for frequently asked questions where a guest can ask the sometimes awkward questions about bringing kids or plus ones. The Zola registry has a wide selection of gifts in all price ranges, and your guests will love the free shipping and returns. With over 500 top brands to choose, from Cuisinart to gift cards like Home Depot, there is something every couple will love. After browsing Zola's website, I wish this company had been around when I got married. The ease of having all of your wedding information for guests, as well as your registry in one place, is such a time saver and really takes the stress out of planning your big day. From engagement to decorating your first home, Zola is there for you. Get started today. Go to zola.com/southernfried for $50 off your registry on Zola. Once again, for $50 off your registry on Zola, Southern Fried listeners go to zola.com/southernfried. That is zola.com/southernfried. On June 17th, Doug Benton was reported missing by his neighbor and friend, Jeff Bennett. Jeff had noticed Doug's exotic birds looked like they had been neglected. Doug usually took great care of the birds, cleaning their cages and feeding them at 6 o'clock every day. Tracy often helped him. Jeff hadn't seen his buddy in a while. They'd had a falling out, again over Tracy. Jeff would later say it wasn't just about not being able to work out. He saw what this relationship was doing to Doug. He insisted Tracy was abusive and violent. He said the couple even pulled guns on each other. Honestly, considering many of the things Jeff said, it would seem to me that both Tracy and Doug were overly aggressive. They were both volatile people with hair-trigger tempers. Both left a trail of failed marriages and relationships. Despite what Tracy would be accused of, I'm not willing to say she was the abuser in this relationship, not just based off of what Doug's admittedly jealous best friend said about her. But unfortunately, he wasn't the only one with a negative view of Tracy Fortson. Jeff's ex-wife, who still lived with him, had a low opinion of Tracy, as did a couple of other friends and colleagues. But I think she was just one of those polarizing types of people. She didn't put up with shit. If she didn't like you, she didn't make any bones about it. I think the only example of Tracy turning the other cheek would have been in her work as a deputy. Because though she did walk out on her job and file that claim, she had been there almost 3 years before this, and she only did it at Doug's urging. Whatever harassment she had faced was not enough to make her do anything about it before. It was when Doug came into her life that she found her working environment unbearable. She also claimed that Doug had a previous beef with Sheriff Ray Sanders and others in the department. It was all part of his mysterious past. She was never sure what it was all about, but she insisted there was something there. That may be true, and I'll address it again later, but I think one thing is obvious now about Tracy and Doug's relationship. They brought out the worst in each other. Both tended to be pessimists and untrusting, and they both definitely blew up any perceived slights in their own minds. Jeff Bennett said the fight he got into with Doug was about Tracy, how they weren't good for each other, but specifically how she was manipulative and violent. Even though Doug had confided about Tracy pulling a gun on him, he didn't want to hear it when Jeff lectured him to leave Tracy. So Jeff walked away. He didn't see his friend for a couple of weeks. On June 17th, when he noticed Doug's exotic birds unattended outside, he walked over. The cages were a mess, and he was hit with an awful smell. Several of the birds were dead. Now he was concerned. He knew his friend took care of the expensive birds. They were a business to him. He used his key and looked around Doug's house, but didn't see anything. But still, those birds worried him, and he decided to call the sheriff. Since Doug lived in Colbert, which was in Madison County, the Madison County Sheriff, Tom Lutz, came to the trailer to check things out. Initially, Sheriff Lutz treated the matter as though Doug had taken off, despite the birds being left unattended. He contacted Tracy, who immediately agreed to talk to him, and she readily admitted that she too had a fight with Doug a couple of weeks before. The two had been arguing a lot, but Tracy said she last saw Doug on June 5th, and that evening she had gone over there to watch a movie. The movie was An Officer and a Gentleman. She said they got in a stupid fight about the movie and Doug had hurt her feelings, so she got up and went home. She said the next day while she was working in her yard, she missed a call from Doug and he left her a voicemail, breaking up with her. This would have been June 6th. The timeline here is important because Jeff's friends and neighbors claimed they last saw him on June 4th. Tracy had an old-school answering machine at the time, but the tape was full, so she said his message did roll over to the voicemail she had on her landline. However, through all of her court wranglings, proof of this call or voicemail has never been found. Once Sheriff Lutz talked to a few more friends, he started treating Doug's disappearance as a missing persons case. His home was searched, and everyone the sheriff talked to claimed Doug might have ran off for a while. His mother still lived in Michigan. It's not like he had nowhere to go. But another friend of his, Jerry Alexander, went to the police and said he had found Doug's truck in his driveway. There was a crudely written note on it asking Jerry to take care of the truck. This note was called into question at trial, with experts saying Tracy could have written the note. But Doug was dyslexic, and handwriting analysis can be tricky. Looking at the note myself, it looks like someone tried to write it with the wrong hand. As in a right-handed person used their left hand. I can see why experts may have believed Doug didn't write the note, but I can't really see how anyone could say for certain it looked like Tracy's handwriting. And the main witness for this assertion? Sheriff Ray Sanders, the man Tracy had filed the sexual harassment suit against. He brought examples of Tracy's handwriting from her time at the sheriff's office. Another problem with this note is that it wasn't discovered by police. Doug's friend Jerry Alexander had it and turned it over. Remember, the car was in his driveway, so he turned over the note once law enforcement started looking for Doug. Interestingly, the tape used to affix the note to the windshield was fingerprint tape, the kind that police officers use to lift latent prints at crime scenes. So while the note is suspect in many ways, the fact that fingerprint tape was used on it is kind of a home run for a prosecutor. On June 19th, an overseer for a 15-acre farm in Winterville called the Clark County Sheriff's Department. He and his wife had been out riding ATVs and noticed a trough partially buried in a part of the property where the owner let people hunt. Remember, Tracy lived in Winterville. In fact, Tracy Fortson did a lot of hunting there and was friendly with the owner. Just getting out and looking, Rob Poston, the overseer, smelled the scent of death immediately. As a property manager for a farm like this, he was well acquainted with the rotting smell of decaying flesh. It wasn't unusual to find game animals either wounded by a hunter or dead naturally, leaving the telltale stench. When he first spotted the trough, he thought someone had just dumped it as garbage. That was common, too. When he looked closer, he saw that it had been painted in camouflage colors and was covered partially with peat moss, as well as being partially buried in the ground. The sheriff called into Oglethorpe County, and Deputy Sheriff Mike Smith came out and brought along Special Agent Ben Williams of the GBI. As the men tried to poke and see what was in the trough, a black, viscous liquid started leaking. They then called EMS and the coroner. As the men worked to get the trough out of the ground, they used many tools, including a pitchfork and a tow truck. They finally got it out enough to start digging at the concrete, at which time Sheriff Mike Smith saw an arm with a tattoo and claimed he recognized it as Doug Benton. The men immediately stopped everything and transported the entire trough, weighing more than a ton, to the coroner's office. There, they were able to get to the body of Doug Benton. He had been wrapped in two shower curtains, placed in the trough, and then the trough had been filled with concrete. It was a messy, difficult job, and despite his tight entombment, Doug Benton's body was heavily decomposed. The almost 250-pound man now only weighed a little over 100 pounds, and a lot of his skin had slipped off. In fact, his hands had been completely denuded. What was certain, though, Doug Benton had been shot in the top of his head. According to the coroner, he had also been stabbed repeatedly in the stomach, hip, and groin area. These stab marks and other cuts were also hotly debated in court. Though the coroner testified that the wounds occurred on or near time of death, with the state of the body, it was impossible to say which exactly killed him. But it seemed more likely he was shot first. Investigators went back to Doug's trailer and this time noticed what looked like tracks from a truck backed up to Doug's porch. Inside, on closer inspection, they found that Doug's white couch had pinkish stains on one armrest and cushion. When this was cut open, the stain deepened to a reddish brown inside, and the blood had dripped between the cushion and down the side of the arm, saturating the carpet below. Investigators noticed a small scented candle close to the arm that was burned down to the quick. And there was also the unmistakable smell of fuel. Investigators tested and found that it was kerosene. It looked pretty obvious that Doug Benton had been murdered on his couch and whoever had done it had tried to clean up. But investigators insist the smell of fuel hadn't been there in their first search of Doug's home when he was just considered missing. This meant whoever had killed him had come in sometime in the last 2 days before his body was discovered and tried to set the place on fire to destroy evidence. As they looked, they now saw candles all over the house burned down and the trail of fuel led back to a wood-burning stove. A search warrant was issued for Tracy's home and she was arrested. At her house, several incriminating items were quickly found. She had a few different guns and lots of ammunition. She had spray paint cans and camouflage colors. There were also two towels stained with what looked like blood, though I find this detail strange. I couldn't find where they tested these towels to prove who the blood belonged to. And Tracy would later rightly insist that there was no actual physical evidence tying her to the scene. They also found a brand new shower curtain hanging in her bathroom, so new that the plastic smell still permeated in her house. The paint cans were found in the bed of Tracy's truck, along with cement splatters and remnants of potting soil. Lastly, they found a Home Depot receipt with 80 pounds of concrete and an 8-foot watering trough on it. Tracy has never denied purchasing these items. She couldn't if she tried. A friend of hers was the cashier and remembered talking to her. Tracy had even asked for help in figuring out how much concrete she needed. She said she was building a pen for her dogs and gave the dimensions, and the man working in that department told her how much to buy. She said the watering trough was for her horse. If that all was true, where was the pen she built and where was the trough for her horse? Well, Tracy had another excuse for this. She said the morning after her last fight with Doug, she had gone outside to find her riding boots, chaps, and some other items sitting in her garage. She said the items she had bought at Home Depot were now missing. She told investigators it wasn't unusual for Doug to get mad at her and dump stuff at her house, just like the dramatic voicemail wasn't that odd. She guessed that he had taken the new bags of concrete and the trough. She also said this was something Doug would have done, taken her stuff to piss her off and then give it back to her once they made up. Look, I've stolen plenty of ex-boyfriends' t-shirts, and I had one ex that kept my iPod when we broke up. But the idea of an ex coming to your house and stealing 80 pounds worth of concrete and a trough weighing more than 1,000 pounds is just ridiculous. Also, she just let this slide for 2 weeks? Hot-headed Tracy Fortson? She had told police that she abided by Doug's wishes he left in the voicemail, which was that she should never call him again. Okay, I'll give her that. But I can't see how she would have let the theft of those items slide that long, especially the trough, which she said she needed for her horse. But Tracy has stuck to that story for quite a while. Later, she began using this theft as proof of a frame job. Tracy was indicted on 5 counts, malice murder, felony murder while in commission of aggravated assault, 2 counts of aggravated assault for the shooting and stabbing of Doug, and 1 count of arson. Tracy's trial started in July of 2001. Her bail had been set at $500,000, which she wasn't able to raise, so she sat in jail for the year awaiting her trial. She was tried in Madison County, where Doug's house was located. Her attorney asked for a change of venue due to the pretrial publicity, but was denied. Honestly, with these small towns so close to each other in bordering counties, they would have had to move it a couple of hours away. And I do think she should have been granted the change in venue. After all, the sheriff's departments of the neighboring counties were friendly. They had to work together. Everyone knew each other, and everyone was in each other's business. But the trial commenced anyway. Along with several of her own colleagues, Doug's friends and neighbors testified against Tracy. Everyone who knew the couple testified to their volatile relationship, characterized as rocky in court documents. And the evidence really did seem damning. There was just so much of it. Her purchasing the trough and concrete, the mess in the back of her truck, and there was also a ballistics expert named Beverly Davy who testified that the shot that probably killed Doug Benton had been matched to Tracy's rifle. Beverly Davy, in 2009, was caught up in a scandal involving her work. She not only made a lot of errors, she outright fabricated evidence by falsifying reports. She left her job with the GBI in disgrace and brought into question every case she had ever testified for. This wound up not really helping Tracy's case, but you should still keep it in your back pocket. Also, along with the circle of Doug's friends testifying, was a woman named Lisa Watson. She was Jeff Bennett's ex-wife. Evidently, though Jeff and Lisa never remarried, they did remain living together, so she was next door from Doug, too. The problem is, Lisa failed to mention this to investigators the first time they spoke, when everyone thought Doug was just missing, nor did she report it after his body was found. 3 months later, when the GBI special agent Ben Williams was re-questioning witnesses, she remembered the shot. She said it was around 4 in the afternoon on June 4th, and when she looked outside, Tracy's truck was in Doug's driveway. She thought the shot came from that direction, but wasn't sure. Tom Camp, Tracy's defense attorney, went after her on cross-examination. Watson claimed she didn't mention it the first time because they thought Doug was just missing. She didn't yet know it was a murder investigation. And besides, gunshots were common in that rural area. But I do still question this, as Doug's body was found just 2 days later, and he had been shot in the head. She didn't think it was important then. Did she forget? Because she seemed pretty damn sure of the date months later when questioned by the GBI agent. I find it hard to believe that she would forget about this mysterious gunshot when her next-door neighbor and friend went missing, and then was found shot dead 2 days later. He was her ex-husband's best friend, the friend who had nasty fights with that woman they both disliked so much. Jeff had told her stories of their drama, and she knew that allegedly, Tracy had held a gun to her own head as well as pointed it at Doug during one fight. This was the fight that made Jeff Bennett break off contact with his friend. If Doug couldn't see how destructive Tracy was, Jeff didn't want to be around to witness it. He considered it tough love. Tracy maintains that, like Jeff Bennett, Lisa just never liked her. This is a common theme in her trial and interviews, and in Michael Phelps' book on the case. He said basically she's one of those people you either love or hate. You either could handle Tracy's personality, which was abrasive, or you avoided her completely. And considering Phelps' own quarrelsome relationship with his subject, I think he would know. And I do think this could explain Lisa Watson's testimony. It's possible she remembered the shot, but it's also possible she wanted to help the prosecution put away this woman they all hated so much. But back to her trial, her attorney, Tom Camp, did score some points. He got Bernadette Davy to admit that she could neither eliminate or identify Tracy's rifle as the one used to kill Doug, which is confusing. Basically, the bullet was fired from a gun like Tracy's, but they couldn't prove it was that gun. There was also unidentified male DNA on the doorknob of Doug's closet. The prosecution could never explain this, nor could they explain the lack of blood in Tracy's truck or home. You would think if she had shot and stabbed the man, there would have been blood evidence of some kind. This is why I find those towels I mentioned strange. They were not introduced as evidence at trial, which makes me think the blood didn't match Doug. Many investigators would point out that there are often odd pieces that don't fit in these cases, and that's true. But it's also true they never did find one piece of physical evidence that actually tied Tracy to the murder. The concrete and trough she bought were circumstantial. She had admitted she bought them, but insisted they were stolen. Everything else in evidence against Tracy was circumstantial too. But Tracy also made a crucial mistake. Before she was indicted, she dropped the sexual harassment suit. She said that she hoped it would make the sheriff back off of her, because she thought it was why they were focused on her in the first place. But since she dropped it, it wasn't admissible at trial. To this day, Tracy claims that someone at the sheriff's department killed Doug and framed her. She believes there was past animosity with Doug and the sheriff, and that that was the motive. Framing Tracy would just be the icing on the cake. When author Michael Phelps asks her how, she said that Sheriff Deputy Mike Smith lived just minutes from her and could easily have seen the concrete, trough, and other materials in her yard. That's quite an accusation, and there is no way to prove it. But all of this didn't matter. When the state rested, the jury only deliberated for 3 hours before finding her guilty on all 5 counts. She was sentenced to 2 life sentences plus 50 years. But that wasn't the end of her story. In October of 2003, Tracy won an appeal and was granted a new trial. The issue on appeal was a peremptory strike of a juror that Tracy had wanted. She recognized the woman and claimed she was an associate of the drug dealer that Doug used to work for. She also knew her anyway from the community and felt like that, combined with her connection to the dealer, should have precluded her from sitting on the jury. Her second trial began in March of 2004, and the major difference here is that the change of venue was granted. The trial was held in Effingham County. There also was a new ballistics expert who contradicted Beverly Davies' earlier testimony. He testified that the bullet fired into Doug's head could not have been fired from Tracy's rifle or one like it. But this jury apparently didn't have any trouble overlooking the ballistics expert. They took only 5 hours to convict Tracy, though they only convicted on the malice murder and arson. Tracy's attorney had spent a lot of time trying to prove the stabs and scratches on Doug's body were made post-mortem when officials were trying to remove him from the concrete-filled trough. From the condition of the body, there was no way to be certain, so the jury did not convict on the aggravated assault charges. This time, Tracy Fortson was sentenced to life for malice murder plus 10 years for the arson charge. And to this day, she maintains she was framed by the same men she claims sexually harassed her. It's difficult to believe that police officers would go that far to dispute a sexual harassment claim, but I suppose it is possible. Her more likely claim is that there was some sort of prior beef with Doug and the sheriff's department. There was animosity there, and she had witnesses to stipulate to this. However, the tape recordings she claimed she had of Sheriff Ray Sanders harassing her had disappeared. She said they were stolen from her house when it was searched. But to believe all of this is possible, you would have to believe that one of these policemen, sworn to uphold the law, crept into Doug Benton's house as he slept on his couch and fired a bullet into his head. And then they went and stole materials from Tracy's home to bury Doug in, to frame her for the crime. But Tracy does have her defenders. The most vocal are her daughter and, incredibly, Doug Benton's mother, Carol. She never believed that Tracy could kill her son. Tracy's daughter, Elise, appeared on a couple of shows like Snapped and Deadly Women. She pointed out that the 5'6", 140-pound woman could not have moved Doug's body, much less that trough, when once it was filled with Doug and concrete, weighed over 1,500 pounds. And to that, I say, Tracy was a weightlifter herself. There were tracks from a truck backed up to his porch. She easily could have left his body for a while, gone and gotten her shower curtains to wrap him up in, and then dragged his body the short distance to the truck. Could a woman like me do it? Hell no. But I don't bench press 100 pounds like Tracy did. And she would have been dragging him, not lifting him. And as far as the trough goes, well, the guys at Home Depot loaded it in her truck. Investigators believe she dragged Doug's body to the edge of the porch, which would have dropped off into the bed of her truck. Then she merely rolled his body into the trough she had waiting. And as far as burying it out on that farm, well, first of all, it was never disputed that Tracy was familiar with the farm and had hunted there herself. Second of all, the trough was only partially buried. It wasn't exactly a neat job. And there were marks on the trees around the burial site. The prosecution contended she tied a rope around the trough and then around a tree, aiming for the hole she dug, and then simply drove her truck forward. The trough would have fallen right there. And it wasn't neatly lying in the hole. It was tilted. And then there is the peat moss and camouflage. The hole wasn't big enough, so she used the paint and moss to try and cover the trough. It's fairly simple. The coroner was certain that Doug was shot as he slept on the couch, and that does seem likely. While I believe she was strong enough to drag his body, I don't think she was strong enough or dumb enough to try and physically subdue him. I think she shot him as he slept. I'm not as certain on the stab marks and scratches. It would be overkill and indicate a frenzied rage, which would track if they had been fighting. Or it could simply be the result of prying Doug out of the cement-filled trough. The evidence can honestly go either way. But I don't think it matters. Yes, it is a circumstantial case, but personally, I like a lot of circumstantial evidence. Juries often glaze over highly technical scientific evidence. Just like the jury in Tracy's second trial basically ignored the ballistics evidence that proved her rifle did not shoot Doug. Which brings me back full circle to could she be innocent? Maybe. And maybe she just got rid of the gun she used to kill him. She wasn't stupid, and many people point out that she went to the nearest Home Depot, where she knew people, to buy the supplies to get rid of his body. They say this is too convenient. That if Tracy wanted to cover up the murder, why would she go so close to home for supplies? But I think it makes more sense that she did that on purpose. She specifically asked questions and made people notice her. Maybe she was trying to set up an alibi for that weekend. She wasn't worried about anyone finding out, and I think that's because she truly thought she could hide Doug's body. Maybe she planned on visiting another store for more supplies to actually put in that dog pen and trough later. It's probable that she honestly didn't expect to become a suspect at all, much less so quickly. Like I said, I don't think she believed his body would be found, at least not so soon after the murder. And the overseer who found it admitted it was dumb luck. He saw a portion of the aluminum on the trough glinting in the sun. She almost had it fully covered. If he had rode past, it may have been months or years before Doug was found. And by then, Tracy would have had more than enough time to cover her tracks. Despite a lot of questions in this case, I do believe that Tracy Fortson murdered Doug Benton. I think she had a messed up childhood and a twisted, violent relationship with her own father that colored the rest of her life. She had seen her father pull a gun on her mother. We know the cycle of violence in these circumstances. It's not a stretch for me to believe that Tracy became a violent adult herself. So I also don't think it's a stretch to believe that in her final relationship with Doug Benton, which by all accounts except hers was extremely volatile, that she was violent. She had pulled a gun on him before. But whatever he did to set her off that night sealed his fate. She didn't fight him straight on, again because she wasn't stupid and had certainly seen what happened to women who did try to fight with men. And the fact that she shot him as he slept proves premeditation. This wasn't in the heat of the moment. She might not have gone to her boyfriend's house that night to kill him, but in the end, she did shoot him and then executed an elaborate cover-up. And it almost worked. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Please check out Michael Phelps' book, Targeted, A Deputy, Her Love Affairs, A Brutal Murder. It's a fascinating book because you do get Tracy's actual words, and the format is so different from most in the genre. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm on most large platforms like Stitcher, as well as a new podcast app called Himalaya. Like you guys, I'm always looking for a better way to manage all the podcasts I listen to, and I really like the ease and functionality of Himalaya. If you're interested in supporting the show, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation. Or you can visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have a merchandise store open. Just go to whatamaneuver.net and click on Shop by Store, then search for Southern Fried True Crime. I have all sorts of t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing this case or any other episodes further, please come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.